Hello, this is Sharon. I'll be bringing you the pantograph for today, Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. As always, we'll begin our reading on the front page with an article today entitled Higher Education, Eureka Builds for Success, College Converting Library into Student Support Hub. In a significant step toward growing student services and support, Eureka College is close to completing its transformation of the Melick Library into a new Student Success Center. Our focus is increasingly on a liberal arts education that is workforce ready, said Eureka College President Jamel Wright. You have to have these types of spaces to ensure those transferable skills. The new center, which is housed within the 27,000-square-foot Melick Library, will centralize key student services, including academic advising, career development, and financial aid. The project, which began in April 2025, has renovated the existing library space into a hub, and construction will involve major updates to the three-story facility, including new offices, conference and study rooms, improved electrical and other systems, and furnishings. As for the Melick Library collection, it will return to the third floor of the center, maintaining usable traditional resources. It also will remain home to the Mark R. Shankman Reagan Research Center and College Archives, which features a collection of published works, dissertations, and master's theses on the life and career of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan, Eureka's most famous alumnus. Wright added that the space also will invite the community to access various resources or attend different events and workshops. A majority of the center will be completed and unveiled this upcoming May, while some of the remaining technological equipment will follow. Wright said the goal is to simply make it easier for students to access the resources they need to succeed. This is a physical representation of our focus and emphasis on student success, where all our academic and student services will be under one roof, Wright said. The total cost for the Student Success Center and Library Renovation Project is approximately $11 million, which has quadrupled from the soft estimates the college received in 2022 for approximately $2.5 million. Wright said that, in addition to costs increasing, there were gaps in skilled workforce availability, such as a lack of electricians, that caused delays. That also shows a broader need to support the interest in the trades and to create businesses, she added. Some of the questions we keep having are, if we support the trades, how can we as an institution be a part of the broader ecosystem, Wright said. The college has received state capital funds and continues receiving what she said were generous donations, including a lead gift of $1.25 million provided by an anonymous donor who was a first-generation college student back in 2022. Wright said a majority of Eureka's student body are first-generation college students, and while small liberal arts colleges nationwide faced enrollment pressures, financial challenges, and questions about long-term sustainability, Eureka is looking towards setting a foundation for future generations. As construction continues, Wright said the building will mirror the ongoing transformation of the student experience on campus, where access is simple, supportive, and tangible. We need to remove barriers and help students better achieve their goals of graduating from Eureka College, Wright said. We're investing in that. Wright has a place in Eureka's history and looks to its future. Eureka College president Jamel Wright describes a sense of purpose she has when she's on campus that leads her to walk to the dining halls and catch up with students throughout the year. In fact, it's funny, Wright said, I sometimes work from home and I tell people I work from home because I really do get a lot more done because when I'm on campus, I'm going to go to one of our dining halls. For Wright, leading Eureka College, a private liberal arts college that lists an enrollment of about 550 students, is not just about sustaining a historic institution. It's about proving that small colleges, like Small Beginnings, can shape outsized futures. To her, that comes from building a supportive community. Wright has been in office for 10 years since stepping into the presidency, first as an interim president in 2016, and then officially in 2017. Her appointment made her the first woman and first African American to serve as president in the college's history of over 170 years. Initially founded in 1855 by abolitionist members of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, Eureka College was a pioneer in coeducation, admitting both men and women on an equal basis. I thought this was the perfect place with the perfect story and perfect history, Wright said. How fitting it is for someone like me to come to Eureka College and end up being the first woman and person of color to serve as president. As a proud first-generation college graduate, Wright earned her bachelor's degree in communications from Missouri Western State University in St. Joseph, Missouri, where she was able to work for Jim McCarthy, the university's former executive vice president at the time. During her time as an undergraduate, she was certified to be a grant writer, established the America Reads program at the university, and was elected as the president of the St. Joseph Area Literary Coalition. Wright later went on to complete both her master's degree and doctorate degree in communication studies at the University of Kansas, and served as an academic advisor and diversity expert at the university. She also taught communications at Boston College and St. Louis University. The youngest of five children, Wright was raised in St. Louis, where her parents, James and Shirley Santa Cruz, jointly owned a cleaning service, and her mother was also a teacher for many years. Wright, 52, said she learned a lot from working in her parents' business while growing up, especially the foundational lessons from her mother of being warm and encouraging with others. This has not only been carried over with the support of her husband, daughter, and son, but also with the incoming students and families that come to Eureka College. It's important to have that community of support, and I think I also bring that to Eureka, Wright said. I want to be able to assure parents as much as possible that their kids are coming to a community where they're going to be supported, where we're going to rally to support them. She continued, but it doesn't mean that we're not going to correct them if they do something wrong, and it doesn't mean that we're always going to say yes. It doesn't mean any of that. But we're going to support them, and that's the same support I received as a college student, growing, and that I still receive, she added. Despite all the concerns revolving around higher education across the country, Wright said she is looking to the future with optimism and excitement as the college continues to support in student success. This will be achieved in part through the opening of the college's new Student Success Center, introducing more career-focused programming, and leveraging partnerships with the community of Eureka itself and other businesses. Wright said she also believes that the founding principles of unity with the Disciples of Christ still hold for the institution as it continues to move forward. all of those things are to come in on the horizon and create some really exciting opportunities for us as we're moving forward, working with our state legislators and our folks in DC, but most importantly, working with the amazing faculty and staff, Wright said. We're using our radical imaginations collectively as a team, rowing in the same direction, focusing on the same goal, and that's what is going to lead this institution to success and what will be in my line of sight for the next several years. City of Bloomington, water and roads feature in the city budget. An historic $82 million investment in water infrastructure projects, a 281% increase, and a $16.6 million earmark for road work are among highlights of Bloomington's proposed $370.5 million balanced spending plan for fiscal 2027. This represents a 16.6% overall increase from fiscal 2026, which was approved last year, but only a 6.8% increase to the substantially revised budget for the same fiscal year, according to the budget numbers reported at Monday's City Council meeting at the Government Center. The City Council reviewed the budget proposal, which now is on display for 30 days for public comment. The water infrastructure budget, meanwhile, swelled due to projects mandated at the state and federal level. If not for these required projects, the fiscal 2027 budget would experience a 3.5% decrease. Capital projects include the next phase of the Locust-Colton Combined Sewer Overflow Project, lead service line replacements and system-wide improvements to pump stations, water mains, and tanks. Bloomington City Manager Jeff Juergens said this required work would be paid for by the increased water rates authorized by the City Council a few years ago. A majority of this is mandated by the federal government and the state government, but also we're talking about 100 years plus old infrastructure in many cases, Juergens said. So not only are we upgrading our infrastructure, this is also going to help us with our water loss of 30% that will indirectly impact water conservation efforts at the two lakes. In November, the City Council approved a roughly $25.3 million levy for property taxes payable in 2026. This is roughly $3 million more than the levy amount the Council has agreed to maintain for the previous two tax years. The staff recommended that the additional revenue be split amongst the police, fire, and park departments. The general fund budget request for fiscal 2027 is $148.3 million, which is roughly an 8.3% increase from last year's adopted budget, but less than 1% higher than the revised total. About $76.3 million of the general fund budget would go to police and fire service, including capital improvements and new firefighter positions. The city's budget for asphalt and concrete work increased from $8 million to $10 million. The city maintenance budget will be another $5.3 million, which includes $750,000 to fund a four-person public works crew that can operate a street paver full-time. The number of full-time positions in the city would increase by 10, and the overall salary increase would be limited to 2.6%. Juergens said there hasn't been a city program that focuses on and significantly addresses neighborhood revitalization. The city typically has had to rely on federal grants like the Community Development Block Grant to pay for housing programs. But this year, the city will be investing nearly $900,000 in revitalization programs. We know that there are about 21 homes that need to be demoed, that are not repairable, that are not salvageable, and this budget would include $250,000 so we could actually go out and start acquiring and demoing these properties, Juergen said. With this budget, we think we can get about half of those done this year. There are another 140 to 160 that still can be rehabilitated, and Juergen said there's additional money to start taking care of these properties. We're not going to fix all of this in one budget year, or maybe even a couple of budget years, but we believe we can start to see real progress, and this is not something the city has embarked upon before, he added. In November 2024, the city was projecting to have a budget deficit of up to $6 million heading into fiscal 2027. However, this estimate assumed that the city would not maintain a 1% grocery tax, which generates roughly $3 million annually. The city council voted to adopt the grocery sales tax in September, replacing the same tax the state allowed to expire. As these discussions were underway, the staff also discussed whether there was sufficient money to issue bonds for upcoming projects, like the new Public Works campus on the site of the former Owen Nursery at 10 Finance Drive. However, the finance department recommended not to issue bonds in fiscal 2027 and make sure revenues come in as projected. The city will instead use money that had been put aside to pay for bonds to instead pay for one-time projects such as downtown parking improvements. In other business, the city council also heard a proposal for a municipal ethics code introduced by Barbara Findlay Stewart. Stewart, who drafted Illinois' first ethics code for a county government roughly 40 years ago, also presented her recommendations to the Normal Town Council last week. Stewart maintained that the ethics code was not drafted in response to the improper action of any elected official. Instead, the code is meant to establish trust and discourage potential offenses. Signing and posting your ethics code publicly will tell people what your intent is and increase trust, Stewart said. The Ethics Committee of Bloomington Normal recommends the proposed code be read aloud annually, signed as membership changes, and always be posted in prominent public place. Today's Flick Fact question. Even if you're bound for Bloomington Normal on a bad day, it's possible your luggage will end up at the Baltimore Washington Airport. Do you know why? And the answer, although luggage is largely processed by barcode scans these days, if a human is sorting, especially if read upside down, it's easy for your bag marked BMI to get directed to BWI instead. And from the past pages of the Pantograph, how time flies locally. 100 years ago, on February 25th, 1926. Stilled and silent forever is the great gun that once belched at the Allied forces. The siege gun arrived in Bloomington yesterday and was moved to the south side of the courthouse, where it will remain until the Legion determines where its permanent resting place will be. 75 years ago, on February 25, 1951, William Monroe has sold the building housing his furniture store at 205 Broadway in Normal to the Eisner Grocery Company of Champaign, operators of the Piggly Wiggly stores. Piggly Wiggly officials indicated that it may be a possible site for the Normal store, now located at North and Broadway. 50 years ago, on February 25th, 1976, the first hurdle was cleared Monday night for construction of a mall shopping center at Zaire Plaza, southeast corner of US 66 and Illinois 9. The Bloomington City Council approved rezoning of 40 acres of land, most of it farmland, to C1 local commercial. And 25 years ago today, February 21st, 2001, spring is right around the corner, but it might seem like autumn for many Twin City residents who'll find themselves with a rake in their hands. In case you haven't noticed, melting snow revealed lots of leaves around town. Besides the ones in yards, gutters, and bushes, there are still some hanging from the tree branches. Not a usual sight in mid-February. The non-native trees seem to be most affected, said Don Schmidt, a horticulturist at Illinois State University. Schmidt said the dry summer forced many trees into early dormancy. Robertson testifies at trial. Desiree Robertson thought her husband was going to kill her the morning she fatally shot him. She testified this week before a McLean County jury. Robertson took the stand Monday, revealing for the first time that her husband had a gun that she was afraid he would use on her, as she testified in her own defense. She is charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder in the shooting death of her husband, 41-year-old Daniel J. Shelby, who died on January 10, 2024, in their home. She was one of 3 defense witnesses called to testify Monday in the trial that began last week before Judge Don Knapp. Assistant public defender Mackenzie Frizzle has said Robertson killed her husband out of self-defense. But Assistant State's Attorney David Rossi said after discovering her husband's affair, Robertson killed Shelby out of rage and revenge. Detective Paul Swanland of the Illinois State Police testified for the state Monday, detailing his involvement in the case. He said he extracted cell phone data which showed threatening messages and voicemails delivered to the woman who Shelby had been engaged in an affair with, as well as texts between Robertson and Shelby. The state's final witness, Illinois State Police forensic analyst Timothy Coher, followed. He told the court he spoke to Robertson on the day of her husband's death. Coher testified he took pictures of Robertson and her injuries, which were shown to the court. As he reviewed the photos on Monday, Coher identified linear discoloration on her neck, which went around the front of her neck and around both sides of her neck. The state rested its case after hearing from the 2 Illinois State Police officials. The defense called 2 witnesses before Robertson took the stand. The first of the 2 was the bus driver who took Shelby and Robertson's child to school. He recalled encountering Robertson the morning of January 10, 2024. The bus driver said he picked up their child at 7:33 a.m. that morning and exchanged friendly waves with Robertson. He said that there was nothing different about that day. McLean County Deputy Megan O'Meara testified to domestic violence incidences reported in May of 2022. O'Meara said she was dispatched to the Ellsworth residence on May 27th for a physical domestic violence report. She conducted an investigation and subsequently arrested Shelby, having determined that Shelby punched Robertson in the face. Robertson told O'Meara that Shelby had been hitting her the day before, and she believed he struck her more than once on May 27th, but she could not remember because of the shock of the blow. Photos taken during that domestic violence investigation were presented in court, showing swelling on Robertson's right eye and a cut on her upper lip. When Robertson took the stand, she described the May 2022 incident and others like it. She said Shelby had a history of both cheating and domestic violence. She detailed stories of the violence experienced at her husband's hand, including once in front of her mother and once in front of Shelby's sister while they visited the sister's residence. Robertson testified she did not report any abuse to police until May 2022, when she said he abused her after he learned that she had had an affair. After he was arrested and taken into custody, Robertson testified he called her from the McLean County Jail more than 20 times, which was confirmed by a call log. Frizzle played recordings from some of the calls, including one in which Shelby said, "You gonna send me to jail for a domestic? That won't stop anything. If I want to do anything to you, what do I have to lose?" On another call, Shelby said, "I promise you they can't hold me in jail, and whatever you thought I was going to do to you is going to be worse when I get out. You're making it worse on yourself." He asked Robertson to get rid of the domestic violence case and the order of protection against him. In another call, Shelby said, "I'm trying to be a nice dude right now. You know how I'm going to get," followed by a noise which Robertson testified was the banging of the phone. In the final call played to the court, Shelby said, "If you don't drop this, you're going to feel it." Robertson said she produced an affidavit in the 2022 case stating she lied about the abuse in order to protect Shelby. This wasn't the only time she lied in an attempt to protect him. During her cross-examination on Monday, Robertson said she lied to police during the investigation into Shelby's death by saying she did not think he would kill her and saying her husband did not have a gun. Robertson said she lied because she was hopeful that Shelby had somehow survived the shots that she fired, and if he did, she did not want to get him in trouble for having a gun. Shelby was previously convicted of a felony and therefore was unable to own or possess a firearm legally, but Robertson said that did not stop him. She purchased her own weapons and obtained both a firearm owner's identification card and a concealed carry license with the idea that if Shelby ever were caught with a gun, she could take the blame. On the day of his death, Robertson said she believed Shelby was rolling to his side to retrieve his gun, which he always kept under their mattress. After he said, "You gonna kill me? I'm gonna kill you." Robertson also told investigators during her initial interview that there were no prior domestic violence incidents beside the 2022 case, which was pending at the time of Shelby's death. She testified she had lied about the history of domestic abuse to protect him, unsure if he had survived the shooting. The state and the defense were expected to make their closing arguments Tuesday afternoon and then turn the case over to the jury for deliberation. We'll take a short break now and then return to the second half of the Pantograph for Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. Please stay tuned.